So, you know, when you meet people who are acting in a twisted and peculiar way, and you ask yourself, they're very manipulative, say, you ask yourself, well, do they know what they're doing? The answer to that could be, well, no. But another answer could be, yeah, but they knew once. They knew when they made the decision to start acting like that, but after they did it 100 times or so and made it into an automatic routine, well, then they forgot its origin and now it runs autonomously. And so now they don't know, but they did know. And so, you know, this is the sort of point, and this is the real point of the existentialist, where clinical psychology and the claims of morality start to become very tightly aligned. And it's something that the psychiatric and psychological industries, so to speak, don't really tackle head on. My experience has been that in these situations, for example, where the person has 5 terrible things going on in their life, that there's just deception twisted in and strewn in all of that. People are betraying each other, and there's no fidelity in the relationships, there's no clear and genuine communication. Everything's manipulation. No one admits to what they're really up to. You know, there's a lot of false and saccharine love, which has absolutely nothing to do with love. It's all for appearance. You know, and you cannot be healthy in a situation like that. I don't think, in my experience, you know, apart from terrible luck, because, you know, you can get cancer, diabetes, or any number of awful things. In my experience, apart from the tragedies of life, there is nothing that hurts people more than deception. Lies do people in. And that's an existentialist claim. The claim is, first, well, life is basically unbearable. That's an existential claim. And then there's the hope that with sufficient caution and attention and clarity of thought and speech, you can master it. You can master it to the point where you could even accept the fact that it's tragic. But if you multiply its tragedy with the use of deceit, it's like, forget it. Because, you know, it's one thing to be hurt. You know, maybe you break your leg. That's one thing. It's another thing to be attacked by 2 or 3 people who break your leg and do everything they can to demean you at the same time. It's like lots of people break their leg and they're not traumatized. It's very few people who can go through the latter experience without being, you know, seriously and permanently damaged. Here's Pascal, one of the first existentialists. When I consider the brief span of my life swallowed up in the eternity before and behind it, the small space that I fill, or even see, engulfed in the infinite immensity of spaces which I know not, and which know not me, I am afraid, and I wonder to see myself here rather than there. For there's no reason why I should be here rather than there, or now rather than then. Now, another thing the existentialists do that's very they're romantics. They're not enlightenment rationalists. And part of the reason they're romantics is because they actually don't believe that life is rational. And Pascal's comment on what the existentialists often call thrownness is a description of the fundamental irrationality of life. It's like, okay, here you are. Well, why you? Why here? Why now? Why the way you look? Why with your family? Why your gender? Well, there's no answer to any of those questions. It's just how it is. It's blind and random chance, maybe. There's this, but even if it's not that, there's something arbitrary about it. And there's something that's arbitrary and not self-evidently just or fair. You know, because maybe you could have been born, you know, there are people around the world who make their living in garbage heaps, right? So there's whole families and whole societies that live out in the garbage dumps, and all they do is pick out, you know, the metal and glass that will enable them to sort of glean out a living. It's like, well, why the hell aren't you born there instead of, you know, sitting right here? So there's an irrational element to that, right? You can't justify it, you can't explain it, and you don't really even know what to do about it, right? I mean, do you owe an existential debt to the people who were born much worse off than you? Or is it just okay that it's that way? Well, it's a problem. That, by the way, is the problem the existentialists called thrownness, which is you're arbitrarily here in that form, and there's no explanation for it. And it's something that's outside of human concepts of, say, justice and equity and fairness and even sensibility. And then Pascal also points to the fact that, well, were rather localized things. You know, you're right there. And there's a lot of what isn't right there around you. So you're a small thing against a big, infinitely large potential span of experience. And that's also an existential challenge. It's the challenge of the finite against the infinite. And that's also an existential problem, which is that it isn't your problem, or it is. It's more a problem. It's just a problem that springs out of being human. One of the immediate objects of contemplation is the fact that human beings are limited, right? There's lots of things we can't do. For example, you're there and you're not there. You know, then that's thrownness from a phenomenological perspective. You're just stuck with what you are. You know, you're a certain height, you have a certain eye color, you're a certain amount of attractive or not. You know, you're verbally fluent, you're smart or you're not, or you're conscientious. Like, and it's just sort of, those are the cards that you've been dealt. And it really is worth thinking about it that way, because who you are in some sense is a consequence of a lot of processes, genetic processes, that are in some ways random. And you've been dealt a particular hand, and then you have to play it. And that hand has limitations. And so people, in some sense, they're offered opportunities by the nature of how they're constituted. But there's also a tragic element to that, which is, well, as you move in life, you bump up against limitations that you cannot transcend. You know, and those are the typical limitations. You bump up against the demands of the social group, which has a tyrannical element. You bump up against nature itself because you're susceptible to illness and to degeneration and eventually to death, and so are the people around you. And so there's this issue at the bottom of being that also presents you with a problem. So life is problematic. You're trying to solve it, and that's what you're stuck with. So that's sort of the parameters of being. So I think in most mythological language, I like to think of mythology, philosophy, and then mythology as like forms of conceptualization that are examining the grammatical structure of being. It's like what's common among sets of people, what's common to the experience of sets of people. And the fact that you are is one of them, and the fact that you are has problems is another. And then a third one is, well, you're motivated at least to some degree to do something about those things. And so that's what makes people heal.
From lashes for days with the Viral Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara to awakening your eyes with lift and color from the Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is the go-to when you want to amplify your everyday look. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin. And for every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to help communities thrive. So every time you use your favorite Thrive Cosmetics product, you're helping communities you care about too. Amplify your everyday. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.
Human in many regards, it's something fundamental that makes them human. So you can think about that as tragic self-consciousness. It's self-conscious because you know who you are, and it's tragic because you also know where your limitations are, and they're fundamental. And that also sets up another set of motivations, which is, well, is there something we can do about this? Can we limit our vulnerability? Can we extend our scope of power? And how do we do that without causing more trouble than we're solving? So with that kind of common problem at the basis of our being, that's also what enables us to communicate, because we understand each other, because we're in the same states of being. So you can talk to someone about your problems without having to explain what problems are, because you can't communicate with people unless there's some things you don't have to communicate about. You need a shared set of assumptions. And one of them is, for example, that you have problems. Another is that maybe you're looking for solutions. Another is that maybe communication about that is helpful. You know, none of those things have to be established before you start communicating, because everyone's already got that, those presuppositions built right into their understanding. Wherever you are, you have some conception of where you are. That's your current understanding of the world. It's flawed. Just because you're here doesn't mean you understand everything about being here. Hopefully, because you have low resolution conceptions. You don't know anything about the people around you. As long as they sit down and shut up and act normally, that's no problem, because you can easily ignore them. But they're full of weird potential, and God only knows when that's going to emerge from one of them. But So I'm saying you know where you are, you have a model of what you are, but it's shallow and potentially flawed. And part of the reason that you can get away with that is because there's this implicit agreement among all of us not to do anything that violates general social expectation. And so that's partly how you can get away with the fact that you don't know anything about anyone. It's like, yeah, they're peculiar, like rhinoceroses and ostriches, and God only knows what they're up to. But hopefully they're socialized enough so they don't show you how peculiar they are when you're walking past them on the street in public. And so you can get away with your shallow knowledge. So, and then you have some sense of where you're going. And you know, maybe that's vague. Part of it, it's going to be there whether you have thought it through or not. And the reason for that is, as we've discussed, the biologists are pretty good at informing us on this part, is that, you know, at the base of your cognitive, emotional, motivational, perceptual structure that gives rise to your being are these systems that are going to push you in some direction as a motivation systems or emotion systems. So if you don't drink water long enough, pretty much that's all you're going to be able to think about and value. And not only that, see the world through. Because when you see the world as a thirsty person, you're not seeing the world the same way that someone who has had plenty to drink sees it. So, you know, so you have this space that defines where you are and this conception about where you're going, and you think where you're going is better, and you have a theory about how you're going to transform the present into the more desirable future, but you can make an error at any level of that conceptualization. And that's sort of a modification of Jeffrey Gray's theory, the cybernetic theorist, because what they believed was that you see the world. You expect certain things to happen when you act. And now and then, when you act, that expectation is violated. And so then you have to reconfigure your behavior or your conception of the future. But that's not quite right, because you don't see the world. You perceive the world through a fog of preconceptions and in a manner that's impaired because of your tremendous cognitive limitations. And what that means is that when you're wrong, you can be wrong anywhere in that model. You can be wrong because you don't know where you are. You can be wrong because you picked the wrong behaviors to manifest. Or you can be wrong because your conception of where you're going is flawed in that you're not going to be happy when you get there, or maybe it doesn't even exist. And I think you see this most painfully when you're in a relationship and you're betrayed. Because if you're in a relationship and you're betrayed by someone, then it's pretty damn clear that you didn't know where you were. Now, it's also then clear you don't know where you're going, and also that you probably don't know what you're doing. So that's very painful. But it's in human relationships in particular, I think, that you find out how fragile your conceptions of the present actually are, and that you're not dealing with the world. You're dealing with a very oversimplified and presupposition-based conception of the world. You know, because maybe you think your partner loves you and is trustworthy. And maybe you think all people are trustworthy, you know, because you're naive. And then you find out, well, if that's love, you don't want any of it. And they're not trustworthy. And then what the hell? It's like, well, you don't know where you are. You don't know where you're going. You probably don't know who you are anymore. You certainly don't know who the hell that person is. And because you don't know who they are or you are, then maybe you don't know who anyone is. And that puts you in a place too. And so one of the things that I've thought for a substantial amount of time is that you can think about that. I'll go back like this. When you're thinking about the structure of the world, and one element of the structure is that there's the place. Those are two serpents, by the way. I just found out about that recently. Two snakes, a very common mythological motif. They represent, this is Tao, right, from the Taoist, from Taoism and from the Taoist thinkers. And Tao basically means something like being or something like the way, which is like the path of life. And it's more phenomenological than scientific. What it's basically saying is that your experience is composed of two domains, always, necessarily. One domain is the orderly domain. And the orderly domain is the place where, when you act, what you expect happens. Or more precisely, it's the place where, when you act, what you want happens. And that's orderly because you understand it well enough so that the snakes don't escape when you walk forward. You know, your limited preconceptions are sufficient so that they map onto the environment as it emerges, as you act. That's an orderly place. And fine, that's not a bad place, you know. It's like most of your experience to be that kind of place, because otherwise it's just too overwhelming, right? But the problem with order is that you can have too much order, and all the variability of your experience can be pushed out, and then you get bored. So the answer isn't total order, and we've also talked about what happens when the answer becomes total order, right? Because that's the totalitarian solution. And we kind of think that maybe it's grounded in not only in fear, but also in disgust, or maybe mostly in disgust. And so the opposite of the orderly domain seems to be the chaotic domain. And the chaotic domain is where you are when you don't know where you are. And that's not a geographical place, although it can be, because you can get lost, say, in the city, and then you're in chaos. But it's more like, it's more often, I think, an interpersonal place. You know, I think people encounter chaos most often, in its deep sense, when their relationships with other people go seriously wrong. Now, I talked to you about these figures before, and I was trying to make... So here's kind of an overview of what I'm attempting to describe to you. So there's one category of representation that has to do with the territory that you inhabit and that you understand. That's primarily social territory, and it tends to be symbolized by masculine and usually like older male symbols. So that's the patriarchal structure. I really think what it is it's a personified representation of the dominance hierarchy structure. So if remember the Lion King, you know, the Pride Rock thing? So the Pride Rock is sort of associated with Simba's father. And so that's that category of symbol is the symbol that I'm talking about. So he used that high place on a mountain as an indicator of dominance structure. You saw that at the opening of the Lion King movie, where all the animals come, they gather around, they all bow before the rock with the king on top of it. And the king, like the lion, is a symbol, generally a symbol of something like solar power, because the lion is a top predator, it's apex predator, and it lives in Africa under the sun, and it has a mane that's sort of like a sun. And then later in the Lion King, we'll actually see this today, you'll see the father lion, Mufasa, yes? He appears in the sky with a solar halo around him. So that's the masculine category. And then the feminine category, I told you a bit about, is a more chaotic category. And it's a chaotic and plastic category out of which new forms emerge. And then one of the categories that we haven't talked about is the category of the individual. And the individual is the hero in hero stories and is the initiate in initiatory routines. And so the hero is the person who is attempting to become a complete biological and historical entity, personality, so that they're capable not only of adopting independent existence, but of adopting independent existence that's productive, and that's productive in a way that's also of benefit to the community. So it's a particular pattern of development. And that needs to be catalyzed by human societies, because in order for a society to maintain its structure and for the people within it to thrive, the developing individuals have to mature to the point where they can take care of themselves in a way that doesn't disrupt the whole social structure. And so that's the path. It's a natural path for human beings, I would say, to some degree, because we're such intensely social creatures. But because we're also quite malleable and complex and also grounded in history and cultural creatures, it's also something that has to be taught both from the perspective of imitation and explicitly. And so a lot of initiation rites, for example, are predicated on the idea that you take the person out of their childhood context, you destroy their personality, usually as a consequence of some quasi-traumatic encounter, and then you refill them with the cultural norms, and that makes them an adult. And so, you know, to some degree, that's what you guys are doing in a very slow way when you make the transition from high school, say, to university, or the transition from high school to a job. We don't, in our culture, we don't have the kind of abrupt ceremonies, though, that are designed to catalyze that transformation. And, you know, maybe that's an okay thing. And then maybe it's not an okay thing. I mean, one of the things that Freud pointed out, and he's absolutely right about this, is that because human beings have such a long dependency period, it's not that easy for us to grow up. And sometimes it takes a shock in order for that to happen. And so one of the potential problems with having a dependency period as long as the human dependency period is that it never ends and that you stay immature forever. And really, I believe that that's the central Oedipal problem that Freud talked about, and I believe also that it's a real problem. Now, whether Freud formulated it, you know, with precise accuracy, that's a different story, but, you know, you got to give the guy a break. At least he formulated it, and it's, I mean, I was much more impressed with Freudian Oedipal theorizing after I did clinical work for a long time, because a large number of my patients, their primary problem is getting the hell out of their family. They just can't do it, and so for them, the world is the family. It's the only thing that matters. It's often parental opinion or something like that. They just cannot break free of it. So, you know, initiation ceremonies, in part, were designed to catalyze that break so that your mother in particular, but also your father to some degree, were no longer the dominant figures of influence. Your personal mother and father were no longer the dominant figures of influence in your life. So, because really that's what maturation means in some sense, is that when you become an adult, the opinions of your parents are as important as the opinions of any other reasonable people that hypothetically care for you, but no more important than that. So, and I told you about some of the symbolic associations that gather around, say, images of the unknown. You could also think of the unknown as unexplored territory, but it's a tricky kind of territory, because if the person beside you does something spectacularly weird, you move from explored territory to unexplored territory as soon as you don't understand what they're doing. So it's not exactly spatial territory. It's more like temporal-spatial territory. It's time and space, because the same place can be a different place from one moment to the next. And that happens all the time when some event that you don't expect occurs in the place that you are. So, and your body is prepared to react. It's instinctively prepared to react to the emergence of chaotic circumstances. It basically does that by hyperactivating your preparation for action, increasing your capacity to pay attention, and preparing you to do a very large number of things at once because you don't know what to do. It's a high-stress reaction, but it's built into you. And it's so interesting, because what that means that is part of what's built into people is the ability to deal with what they don't understand. It's a real paradox, right? Because how can you deal with what you don't understand? You don't understand it. So, but the answer is, well, you ramp up your ability to react in a very large number of ways. And you do that by increasing your general level of arousal and your attention. And it's a good, that also increases the probability that you're going to be attentive to new information and pull it in and utilize it so that you can decide how to act rapidly. So, other things happen. For example, you know, some of you may have been in car accidents or events like that where you knew for a few seconds that the event was going to occur and time slowed down. It's quite a commonly reported phenomenon. I've experienced it a number of times, actually. And it was actually experimentally tested. They threw people off bungee cord apparatuses, you know, so they were plummeting down, you know, in a quite frightening manner, and had them look at digital timers that were flashing information while they were falling, and it turned out that the people who were falling could process the digital information faster than people who were just standing there under normal circumstances. How they got that past an ethics committee is beyond me, but it's a brilliant, it really is a brilliant experiment. So I went through some of the symbolism of the unknown. I want to go through some of the symbolism that's associated with the known today, so give you some sense. Flags are definitely patriarchal symbols. They're cultural symbols. And here's some, I'll just lay out a variety of terms, and so that'll give you some indication of the network of associations that's associated with the symbol of the dominance hierarchy, fundamentally. Culture, Apollinean control, that's after Apollo, the god, superego, the conscious, the king, the patriarch, the plow, because the plow opens up the earth, the phallus, order and authority, and the crushing weight of tradition, the wise old man and the tyrant, dogma, the day sky, the countryman, the island, the heights, the ancestral spirits, and the activity of the dead. Now, these symbolic realms are kind of, they're situationally transformable. So if you look across cultures, Very frequently in stories, you see characters that exemplify each of these categories, but the characters can shift to some degree. For example, so often if the story involves the ocean and an island, then the ocean will be feminine and the island will be masculine. But if the story utilizes an island and the air, then the island will be feminine and the air will be masculine. So it isn't as if there's a one-to-one correspondence between the entities in the story and these archetypal categories, because their definition depends on... they can't be defined in isolation. So it's sort of like... this is a really stupid example, but it's the best one I can come up with at the moment. If you're trying to interpret statistics, you can't understand what a given statistic means unless you know the number of people in the experiment, the effect size, and the probability that that effect size is... that it emerged at a better-than-chance level. Any of those pieces of information without the other two are actually meaningless. And it's the same situation here. You have to have the representation of culture, and you have to have the representation of nature, and you have to have the representation of the individual. And then you can figure out what entities are being used in those different categories, even though there's some similarity across stories, which is partly why you could actually understand stories, right? Because if there was no similarity across them, then you wouldn't be able to understand them.